Coming up on Tech News Today, YouTube founders mixing up mobile video. Is CBS encouraging piracy? Is Acer going to dump Windows for Android? So many questions, so many answers coming up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Thursday, August 8th, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 26 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code TNT8. And by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymously and without oversight. For 20% off your new account, go to ProXPN.com/TWiT. And use the code TNT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Aya Zakhtar.
I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show where we take the tech news of the day, figure out like, okay, this is the stuff everybody's interested in, put it in some context for you, starting with the top 10 stories of the day in the news feeds. YouTube co-founders Chad Hurley and Steve Chen's new company, Avos, has released a new mobile video app called Mixbit. Mixbit users capture up to 16 seconds of video at a time, then use the app to edit it up. They can edit up to 256 clips into a story, into a little video. You can even take video clips from other users' posts to put it in your own. We'll see how that plays. Final videos can be shared on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, and of course on Mixbit itself. Mixbit hit iOS today and should be coming to Android soon.
Good news first. T-Mobile has increased its subscriber base for the first time in over 2 years. The company added a net 1.1 million customers in the second quarter, with 688,000 of those coming from its postpaid customers. It also added 8.9 million customers from its acquisition of MetroPCS. So here's the bad news. Even with 27.5% increase in revenue to $623 billion, T-Mobile still lost $16 million overall, compared with a profit of $207 million last year.
The Uncarrier with unprofits. Remember the whole ebook price-fixing thing where DOJ said Apple and a bunch of publishers rigged prices of ebooks? Well, the five publishers who settled with the DOJ are now opposing the U.S. government's proposed injunction, whereby Apple and other ebook retailers like Amazon would be able to discount the publisher's ebooks for 5 years. The publishers say that the injunction is punishing them, and it directly conflicts with the settlements the publishers made with the government.
I know. It seems like we just had IDC mobile market share numbers. Time flies when you're dominated by Android. IDC estimates Android accounted for 79% of all smartphones shipped worldwide in Q2, growing 74% over last year. Android took 13% increase in shipments, and iOS increased shipments by 20%. Windows Phone has solidified its numbers, growing 78% year over year, while BlackBerry declined 12%. The Android dominance may be peaking, however, in the U.S., as ComScore reported users in the United States declined for the first time ever.
Microsoft's Xbox One console, due to go on sale in November, will have some key features only available with an annual subscription. Recording and sharing of gameplay videos, making Skype video calls, and using a service that finds gaming opponents will all require an Xbox Live Gold account, currently running you $60 per year.
Aereo announced it's expanding its service to some big markets. Miami will get Aereo service starting on September 2nd. Houston gets broadcast TV via the internet starting September 16th. And if you're in Dallas, Aereo launches for you on September 23rd.
Remember the Xerox copier compression error, which swapped measurement numbers on floor plans? We talked about it earlier. It's been patched. Hooray. Xerox says the issue only arose if users altered the default settings in its WorkCenter copiers to a lower resolution, weirdly called normal resolution. The machine even warns users that character substitution errors may occur if they change it to that setting. The patch, which should come in the next couple of weeks, will not so much fix the problem as disable the setting that causes it. You know what they say, if you can't fix it, break it.
A federal judge has ruled that bitcoins are a currency or form of money and therefore subject to relevant U.S. laws. In the case of a Texas man accused of a big bitcoin-based fraud, the case revolved around Bitcoin Savings and Trust, a virtual-based hedge fund that many suspected of being a scam. It shut down in August of last year, and the SEC last month formally charged the founder, Trendon Shavers, with running a Ponzi scheme.
Huawei will offer a new line of switches with streamlined upgrading compared to the ease of upgrading apps on a smartphone. You know, Huawei makes smartphones. The software programmable S12700 series will be released in October. The U.S. Congress has accused Huawei of cooperating with Chinese intelligence services and barred government agencies from purchasing Huawei networking equipment. Chinese media have been calling for more Chinese-made networking equipment, accusing Cisco of cooperating with the U.S. NSA on surveillance.
The New York Times reports that the National Security Agency is searching through the contents of Americans' data who merely mention information about foreigners under surveillance. These Americans don't need to be in direct contact with anyone under surveillance. They just need to cite information linked to those foreigners, like a little used email address, and that will lead to the NSA copying emails and other text-based communications. According to the Times source, the keywords that lead to the collection are very precise to minimize the number of innocent American communications that were flagged by the program.
This episode of Tech News Today brought to you by Shutterstock.com. If you're looking for the perfect image, if you're like, you know, look, I've got a video, I need some B-roll, I'm making a website, I need that perfect stock photo image, or I'm making a brochure, you got to check out Shutterstock.com. It's high-quality stuff. Many contributors are professional photographers and artists. Shutterstock reviews each image individually for quality, but they still add 10,000 images a day, so every time you visit, you're going to find something new and awesome. You can choose individual image packs or a monthly subscription for the best deal. You can download 25 images a day with a standard subscription. That's plenty. And you can download any image in any size. You pay just the one price. Shutterstock gives you the images you need for your creative projects. The new Spectrum tool can sort images by color spectrum. You can even search by things like emotion and gender. And the shareable light boxes are great if you're working on a project with a bunch of other people. You put all the assets together in that light box and then share it out. Everybody can contribute to it and say, okay, I think we've got all the stuff we need. And then you buy it. It's a complete global offering. And I use it all the time on my own blogs because I'm like, I just need that one weird image to go along with this podcast. Where do I find it? I find it on Shutterstock.com. No credit card needed. Just start an account. Begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like. Save some images to a light box to review later. Then, if you decide to purchase, use offer code TNT8 and new accounts will receive, get this, 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com. For 30% off new accounts, use offer code TNT8. We thank Shutterstock for their support of Tech News Today. Joining us now to discuss the stories of the day, welcome to the round table. Actually, you're at the real table over there in Petaluma.
I'm in the official Tom Merritt chair of the Twit Studios.
I feel like you have a new job every time we have you on the show. You're now editorial director at Make. Were you doing that yet last time we had you on?
No, I was not. This is a wonderful new thing. It's going on about 3-4 months now. I got hired just before Bay Area Maker Faire, which was a blast to see from
right
the inside this time.
Yeah.
And it's just an amazing group of people to be working with. And, you know, the maker movement is such a tremendous upswelling of creative energy. And just sitting on top of that and trying to spread the word is an amazing job.
Well, congratulations on that. Makezine.com. Of course, you're still editor at large at Geek Dad.
Absolutely. Still going strong.
Yep, going well. Let's get into the stories of the day. And let's start by talking about Mixbit. I gave it a whirl this morning, Sarah. What did you think of it?
Did you have as much problem just playing videos as I did?
Not playing the videos, no, actually. But my sister-in-law was complaining about that on Twitter. She's like, I can't even play your video. And then once I get it to play, it won't stop.
I think a lot of people were hitting it just because it's brand new this morning. So that should probably even out a little bit. But the statistics are we've got a web and an iOS version of Mixbit. This is from the founders of YouTube, Chad Hurley and Steve Chen. We heard that they were putting together something that was mobile video based, and now we kind of see what's going on. Android version is due out in a few weeks. And like you said in the news views, Tom, it's 16 seconds total per clip, but in a complete video, you can put together up to 256 clips into an hour-long video. So that already puts something like Mixbit totally in a different realm than Vine, which is only 6 seconds total, or Instagram, which is 15. the idea is not just to record a bunch of clips and put together something interesting, but once you've done that, you can rearrange the clips, you can reorder them, you can delete various clips, so you put them in the type of order that makes you happiest, go ahead and publish. And then the emphasis is off of you and your friends sort of following each other and commenting. So me as a user of Mixbit, I upload a video and it's sort of just in there in the community. And as long as I haven't uploaded it to private, Iaz or Ken or you, Tom, you find it and you can take portions of my video to remix into your own creation. So it's almost a little bit of what I remember Mixel being, which is an app we talked about way back when that doesn't really exist in its current form anymore. And you don't comment on each other's videos. So it's not really a popularity contest. It's sort of an anonymous community where everybody's contributing. Very interesting approach and kind of makes me uncomfortable because it's so different than the way that I'm used to social networks being set up. But I don't know, Ken, do you think it's kind of freeing to have the emphasis taken off of who has the most followers?
I think that's lovely. I think, you know, this is going to let creativity and just everybody try what they want to do. I also think this probably will see a tremendous explosion of the Hitler finds out about something videos. Because if you think about it, you know, you could have all these stock 16-second shots around, and if it's that easy to mix and match stuff, you're going to have people creating, you know, remixes of things like the Hitler finds out about video just on the street any day. It could explode.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things about portable devices, phones and whatever, is that video editing is never a fun experience. If you're on a desktop, if you've ever been an editor, it's not fun. Vine kind of made it cool. You could do stop motion things. And sometimes you're like, oh, what if I could switch scenes or maybe do these other things? It almost looks like Mixbit with its really long time limits, like over an hour. You could put together something really pretty good. I mean, right now we're seeing people cooking ribs, but I'm really curious when something like an iPhone is going to be used or an Android phone will be used to make a movie based on this, because you can really do things like just moving clips. That's something that's pretty big and has that real tactile feel. So maybe it'll bring some real video editing ease anyway to smaller devices.
Sort of like what the iMovie app was supposed to do and hasn't quite pulled off. And yeah, but now you're like mixing and matching your vines. It's going to be really interesting to see what people do with it.
It was dead simple to edit this stuff. It was the interface isn't exactly as intuitive as it should be for other things. Like when I wanted to actually upload it and share it to Twitter, it was kind of confusing. And I'm still not exactly sure how I got to the Twitter screen. I think it was a long press and a slide or something. But once I got to that video editing portion, just grabbing the frames and moving them back and forth was really simple. I do think, though, that it's turned off a lot of people this morning with kind of some bugginess and some weirdness with the servers and video playback. So they're going to have to scramble to get that. That's typical launch day stuff, and hopefully they don't lose too many people's interest.
Otherwise, and I can see where, I was playing some Coachella video, and it was really jerky, and I could tell that it was just too many people hitting, the particular server at once. But in general, and there it is, in general, I think it's set up really well. I think it's a little clunky that you create on an app, but then you can pull other people's creations only on the web version. And by the way, I tried to hit that web version on Safari with my iPad, and Mixbit said, nope, can't do that. Can't do that on an iPad yet. So it knew that I was coming from a mobile browser. So that's a little strange to me, but I assume within time, the two will converge a little bit more.
Yeah, that is a little odd. All right, let's talk a little bit about the TV battle, CBS and Time Warner Cable, some of the fallout from it. We've got some numbers coming from Torrent Freak saying that, as you might expect, piracy is spiking in the markets that no longer have CBS on Time Warner Cable because of their carriage dispute. Downloads of CBS's Under the Dome were about 10.9% coming from areas that are in the blacked out markets before the blackout, and they've risen to 14.6% afterwards. New York City alone went from 1.3% to 3%. This is not a scientific sample, but you can say, okay, there's one data point. We definitely have seen an uptick in a CBS show, CBS's most popular summer show, being downloaded unauthorized versions off of torrents. Under the Dome is available legally if you're an Amazon Instant Prime version viewer. So you would think that, well, there is a legal alternative. Maybe a lot of people don't know about it or don't want to sign up for Prime. At the same time, Time Warner Cable is telling people to go get Aereo in New York. A little news regarding Aereo. They're expanding to Miami September 2nd. They're coming to Houston September 16th and Dallas September 23rd. That's in addition to rollouts coming soon to Salt Lake City and Chicago. So really what's going on is CBS is suing Aereo, one currently legal or at least quasi-legal way of getting the stuff. They're blocking Time Warner Cable internet subscribers from seeing CBS.com and finding their shows legally that way. Ken, am I just being dumb, or is CBS actually encouraging the piracy rates to go up?
You know, it seems like it. It occurs to me if people are actually able to track what, you know, the piracy numbers are going up because of this blackout, well, why don't we just start rolling that into the Nielsen ratings anyway? I mean, you know, if as long as the commercials are getting fed into those downloads, let's sell ads against pirated video.
Yeah, but the ads are always taken out of the torrent stuff.
Yeah,
as I understand it.
Well, maybe CBS needs to have their own torrent.
That's it. The official.
But like
CBS
persistent
torrent.
Lower thirds that constantly say, this episode brought to you by CBS and Tide.
Yeah.
But just constantly up, so you can't remove it at some point. 16 by 10 is 16 by 9.
Well, product placement gets around that anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody's driving Toyotas on certain shows or Mitsubishis or whatever. It's, you know, that's the way you make the ads.
And Aereo is a perfect example of what you're talking about. Aereo takes the CBS signal off of the air and delivers it to you over the internet and with all the ads. Right? Exactly. It's using a sling box with your antenna. And yet CBS is against it because they don't get a carriage fee. And that has become the new norm since the 90s, is to actually charge the cable companies to carry your local stations. That's additional revenue that these stations don't want to give up. I get it. If I'm getting additional revenue, I don't want to give it up. But at the same time, that's not recognizing that the landscape has changed. And I'm not excusing the piracy either. I'm not saying, oh, people should go download things unauthorized because they have no choice. But I think it would be in CBS best interest to realize that that's just a social reality and combat it that way.
Yeah, just like the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, the viewers will find a way to consume their media.
Piracy will find a way.
Media will find a way.
Yeah,
actually, I think the television industry probably does look on its viewership sometimes as a horde of raptors.
Right. And we think they're just dinosaurs.
It's an oddity, right? Because the CBS content that's being pirated is the over-the-air stuff. So if for some reason, if you're watching like a Time Warner cable system, you don't have CBS, if there was just like when you went to Channel 2, it said, here is a website where you can buy an antenna and you can get the stuff for free and you don't have to pay the fees and all these other silly things. It's just a weird, almost seems like it's a remnant of like back when TV was over the air. Now these companies are very much like cable fees really make our bottom line, and they're causing these silly fights. I don't know why CBS is so, I don't know, aggressive. They seem very aggressive when it comes to not hurting consumers, but they don't seem consumer friendly. It's like you want to watch their shows, and they're like, nope, you can't watch it this way or that way or this way. What's the point of that?
Yeah, it's you know, we have a business model that's not working. Other people are figuring out better business models than we are, so we're going to throw a tantrum.
Yeah, and I feel that's exactly what they're doing with Aereo. I understand why they're angry, but they seem to be overdoing it. With Time Warner Cable, they're also overdoing it. Why block CBS.com and just further anger the people whose hearts you're trying to win over in this dispute? That just doesn't seem like a good PR strategy, if anything else.
What, they're trying to turn people against Time Warner? That's their little scheme. It's like, oh, you can't get
blocking
Time Warner stopping you.
It doesn't make you hate Time Warner.
It's just dumb propaganda is all I'm saying.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to a very sad story. Canonical and the Ubuntu Edge just got a price drop. That Indiegogo is not looking good halfway through.
Yeah, right now, so there's 14 days left on the Indiegogo project that is the Ubuntu Edge. And they've dropped the price for everybody can get an Edge, which is a really high-powered phone that should come out next year that runs Ubuntu and runs, full desktop Ubuntu and also a phone version. It's now $695. Canonical is saying that it's still trying to raise $32 million. And this new price of $695 will remain the fixed price for the next 2 weeks. There's no limits as to the amount of people who can order it or quantities. And they're saying because they've received some major industry backing, also announcing that Bloomberg LP snapped up the first of the $80,000 enterprise bundles. So they got some serious money here. At the end of the campaign, anyone who's pledged over $695 will receive a refund. Now, this campaign in particular, though, is a fixed funding kind of campaign, which means if they don't raise this money, over $20 million in the next 14 days, they're not going to receive a penny. So they didn't do that flexible funding thing like a lot of other people did. Ken, we've got 2 weeks left, $20 million to go, $695 price, that's not going to change. Is this device just not broad enough, or is this something that can actually be overcome with this price cut?
I would say that there are two strikes against it. First of all, Ubuntu, Linux, other than, you know, the, what, few percent of real hardcore people that love Linux, and Linux is wonderful, they're not going to, you know, nobody's going to know what that is and why they should care about the phone. Secondly, we're running into, obviously, the no-carrier subsidy problem. $695 for a phone? What do you mean? I can go down and get my iPhone for $199 and a two-year contract, and I'm perfectly happy. I think that those two things mean that the market is so small for this phone that it can't go anywhere.
Why do you think that they chose to go with the fixed price? Because Indiegogo does offer we'll raise as much as possible and then we'll go from there. I mean, did they look at their production, you know, cost and potential timeline of the whole thing and just have decided if we don't get another $20 million, it's actually just not worth it to go into production?
Maybe minimum order costs for components and so forth that you know, you have to have a certain level to make the costs come down.
It just seems like in this case, I know that there's sort of a, you know, part of the reason that Indiegogo or Kickstarter campaigns end up raising money is because it's like, hey, let everybody get on it. If you care about this, get involved in the next 2 weeks. So you're kind of creating an artificial sense of urgency. But why not just extend it? They've raised quite a bit of money, not nearly as much as they need, but it's not as if the interest isn't there.
Yeah, I think Ken pretty much nailed it as far as the, like, the price and the lack of widespread interest in Ubuntu. And maybe another factor in here is people who don't really champion Linux, but may be sympathetic to it, may be knowledgeable enough to say, well, Android's Linux, so, you know, why do I need to go all the way there? And there's a little Google is evil feeling out there these days, but apparently not enough to really drive this. I guess Canonical hasn't made the case well enough why this phone, forget about, you know, a personal cause or loyalty to a brand, why this phone is a great phone that everybody should get excited about.
Yeah, and they want to do hardware, right? So the thing is, if you're doing Linux, one of the reasons why I do Linux is it's free. You get free stuff, and $695, you can build a pretty powerful machine. If you're not putting $100 into the operating system or $300 for the operating system, you get a free version of an operating system, runs really well on a $695 machine. The fact that they want to sell a really high-end piece of hardware, I like this idea. I love the idea of, okay, this is a bleeding-edge kind of tech person's device. But the thing is, they wanted $32 million to get it. And that seems like it was really the problem. If they were repurposing an older device, or they could figure out a way to make it run on something on older specs, and that way the goal would be somewhere like $10 million, because they're at $8.7 million right now as of this recording. So it seems like they have raised significant interest. This is a lot of money they've raised, but it's just nowhere near what they need to do to make this thing a reality.
Yeah, why not put out, you know, find out what phones already exist that have the right specs and have the wonderful fan base of Linux and Ubuntu supporters go hack the phones to do it. Find out what the right one, or, you know, take a little bit of a deal with the devil and go find a manufacturer like HTC that makes great hardware, is having a challenge right now. Say, hey, how about we do an Ubuntu phone? And guess what? You don't have to pay an iOS fee to get an operating system on there. We'll work with you. We love your hardware. And put out something that people can afford, you know, a $99 phone instead.
This could be good for HTC or LG. Any of those companies right now could be like, oh, yeah.
It would be an amazing differentiator. Here is a new, well-baked operating system, and it's new for, you know, 90% of the people out there. They've never seen this before in a phone form factor. It could be a really great differentiator.
Yeah, I think it's a little chicken and egg factor there, though. Ubuntu needs to show definite interest in it before those manufacturers will get on board with them. And to show interest, they're doing the Indiegogo. And to get people to back the Indiegogo, they have to have top-end hardware. If you put medium hardware on there, they're not as likely to get excited and want to back it in the first place. So it's a tough one. Let's take a quick break and thank our other sponsor for today's show, ProXPN. More than ever, every day. We had a couple of stories in the news feeds today. Online freedom and privacy are a big concern, under threat. Governments, hackers, all kinds of people trying to see what you're doing on the internet, especially if you're out there using free Wi-Fi anywhere. You need to use a VPN, and I use ProXPN. I use it all the time. When I'm traveling, I even use it in the house sometimes when I'm just like, you know what, I want to make sure that this is not looked at by anyone, anybody who might be surveilling. ProXPN is great for that. 512-bit encryption tunnel gives you online privacy, lets you do all the things you would normally do. I can surf the web. I can do my email. I can do file sharing. I can use instant message programs. I can even stream some video. Protect yourself against any kind of pop-ups or redirects or anything your ISP is doing with the six strikes rule. Bypass internet filtering, bypass geographical restrictions. You can use it on your Windows and your Mac. Somebody was like, hey, I want to use it on Linux. Linux comes with its own VPN client, and they've got OpenVPN and PPTP, so you can use it there. You can use it on your phone. ProXPN also works with your corporate Wi-Fi. Gives you complete total privacy while you're at work. World-class customer support. Why not give it a try? Go to proxpn.com/twit for more information. Sign up. ProXPN premium accounts, normally $9.95 a month or $74.95 a year, but we've got a special offer. Use the code TNT. Receive 20% off the lifetime of your account. That's less than $5 a month on the yearly plan. If you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days for a full refund. Go to proxpn.com/twit. Sign up with the code TNT. We thank ProXPN for their support of Tech News Today. All right, we got some good news and bad news about Xbox today. So let's start with the good news. The good news is Larry Erb, Major Nelson, director of programming at Xbox, did an unboxing video today. It was rather gorgeous. And one of the things he uncovered in there was a headset. We didn't know if a headset was coming in there. Do we have that queued up?
And both the day one and standard editions of the console include this MonoChat headset. Improved comfort, inline audio controls, and improved audio quality for in-game chat. One more thing I haven't shown you.
They also have a 4K capable HDMI cable in there if you care about that stuff. So great unboxing. Thing looks pretty. Got to see all the ports, all that stuff. Got pretty excited. But then there's also stories out today about the fact that you're going to need Xbox Live Gold, which is $60 a year, for pretty much everything worth doing on the Xbox One. Obviously, you need it for multiplayer gaming. And things like Netflix have always needed it. Using the browser has always needed it. But if you want to use Skype on the Xbox, gonna have to pony up. You want to use OneGuide, that video recommendation engine that watches your behavior and makes YouTube and TV recommendations? Yep. You're going to, if you want to do game DVR, if you want to do the NFL on Xbox, all that stuff requires you to pay for Xbox Live. So, Ken, headset, 4K HDMI cable, but you're going to have to pony up. Most people are probably going to pay anyway, right?
I have teenage sons. We have, you know, family gold already. That will no doubt keep going. This will be on the Christmas list this year. I think it's funny. I think it's amazing. This is going to be a great piece of hardware. This is where they needed to go next. I think there's a little bit of humor with all of the trouble Microsoft has been having with Surface and with Windows 8 and so forth. That this is the realization of that. the UI design. It's the same thing. We've found the one place where Microsoft's new UI design is going to be successful, and it's on our televisions and in our living rooms.
But if I go to the PS4, granted, I'm going to have to pay for multiplayer gaming, but I don't have to pay for anything else, and it's cheaper to begin with.
Yeah, well, you know, we are in the appified society, so all the extra features you're going to have to pay for anyway. How long can we assume things are going to be free? You know, the original Xbox didn't have any of it. You didn't have to spend extra on top of games. But all the new features are pretty significant. The level of interactivity and communication, you know, I don't sweat it. These are the models that we're going to have to live with in the future as all of these technologies are finally brought from the fringe into our living rooms. And, you know, instead of having to pay for our hardline telephones, we now have, you know, we pay for cell phones. And instead of, I know, 1,000 different things that we used to have to do manually or never could even conceive of doing before, now we're going to be doing them over our television sets in the comfort of our living room. So I don't sweat $60 a year.
Yeah, people seem to love to complain about the fact that, oh, if I pay for Netflix, I have to pay $60 to access it on the Xbox. That's crazy. Because why would you buy an Xbox just to do Netflix in the first place?
Right.
That's not what it's for. It does like every single media thing you could think of. The $60 is really about getting all the like the games you get per month. I think that's part of the new Xbox One deal, the Xbox Live, that is. You get all these game trials. You get to do applications. You get to do – obviously, some of these things seem silly that you have to pay to have an online connection for Netflix, but it's like one out of like 500 things you can do with it. Right. $60 a year still doesn't sound too bad, because if it's like – if it was like $60 a month, I would have a serious problem with this.
Yeah,
$60
I mean, a year? Compare.
I would hope so. Yeah, I mean, why Skype, though? I mean, why put Skype behind some annual fee? Skype is like free, always. I mean, that's what I equate with free video calling.
It's what like can you get away with? What will the market bear?
Yeah, and it almost seems like they bundled it in because people go, one guy, and I don't care about recommendations. NFL, I don't watch football. Skype I use. I should pay, you know? It's almost like a little bit of a mind trick.
But if Microsoft wants this box, and they do have every indication they want this box to be your TV box, for those who aren't already playing games, right? This all makes perfect sense if you're like, hey, I'm an online game player anyway. I'm going to pay that $60, throw all that stuff in there behind. I don't care. But if I'm trying to convince somebody, hey, buy the Xbox One, because maybe some people in your family want to play games, but you're going to get Netflix. We're going to have this DVR. It's going to hook up to your television. All of a sudden, it's like, wait, but I also have to pay $60 a year to access Netflix, which I already pay for. Then that argument starts to make sense to me.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a platform. You know, you're paying for a membership for a new platform. This is like doing an Amazon Prime membership. You know, you're getting a lot of great things for that extra money a year. Let's think about this. $5 a month compared to, you know, and balance that against all of the additional features that this allows. It doesn't seem bad. I mean, first of all, what is the price of the machine itself, the system? Compare that to the price of trying to hook up, you know, maybe a nice computer to your television set. And how much would that computer cost? And then ease of use is going to be 1,000 times better than any media center that you have on there.
The Chromecast. Chromecast versus Xbox One. You're right. They do the exact same
thing. But it connects my computer to my television set, and it gives me Netflix without charging me extra. I'm just saying.
Yeah, what's the ease of use of the you know, compare the ease of use of the two things.
Well, we could argue this all night.
We could, totally.
Let's move on to Max Levchin trying to make us healthier, particularly around the babies.
I had to take this story because it was just such a weird thing to wake up to this morning. Yeah, so Max Levchin, PayPal co-founder, entrepreneur, very successful, wants to reduce the cost of healthcare in the U.S. This is actually something he spoke about at the D conference back in May. And his startup called Glow just launched an iOS app, which is targeting the fertility industry. So what goes on is Glow uses data science to predict when a woman might be the most fertile. So this is supposed to not replace actual medical science, but be able to give somebody a very good indication of what's going on without medical treatments, which certainly in the U.S. are usually never covered by insurance. And patients often pay many, many thousands of dollars to get information that might, you know, be a little bit more within their control. So you can receive data about yourself by providing specific answers. I would show you. I went ahead and put together Glow, but I'm not trying to have a baby. And also some of it is like kind of personal. So I won't show you my specific app, but you can tell them stuff about yourself. But then it's not just your data, but it's also anonymized data from the community at whole. So the system is supposed to get smarter as it goes along. Just, hey, if you're 37 and you know, you and your partner may have been trying for a certain amount of time and you've been unsuccessful, you know, there's data that may help the next person, type of a thing. What you can do, though, that's sort of helpful is you can export data into a PDF and share it with a doctor. And this is just, in general, sort of the first step. It's not just that Max Levchin and his company want to deal with fertility. It's about putting more power into the hands of regular people who didn't go to medical school and maybe don't necessarily need to pay money for tests right off the bat. They can get certain knowledge of their own using something like an app. Also, the company has established, this is really interesting, something called Glow First. So as a participant in this project, I could put in $50 per month for 10 months into a community pool. After 10 months, the pot would be divided equally between the women who didn't end up getting pregnant, because of course this app is designed for that. And then the funds go towards making sure that everyone who contributed can afford necessary treatments. So it's a little bit of a, hey, almost like a, gosh, I was going to make a Monopoly reference, but that doesn't seem appropriate right now because we're talking about babies. But it's sort of real money that could actually help real people afford real treatments down the road. So it's a bit of a community effort. My first question here is this app going to be misused by people who are trying not to get pregnant, and then they're going to go ahead and say, Max Levchin, you told me I was in the free and clear, and now you should pay?
Yeah, I think there are liability questions here that he's probably got a think tank of lawyers working on. I think you can also put on your tinfoil hat a little bit and worry about how secure the data is. You know, dealing with personal medical history records data is always a scary thing, and whether or not, you know, oh, maybe insurance companies start asking about, well, if you share your data with us, we'll save you $10 a month on your medical insurance or something like that. I would love to see this done well. I would love, you know, these sorts of tools to become robust and really help people. That's the promise of all of this technology, is for it to help people. You know, it's just going to have to evolve very carefully, and hopefully, you know, the people with the best intentions are going to be the ones making it work for us.
As long as the users don't use this like gospel or fact. It's more, I'm sure there's a bunch of stuff that you sign up for when you have that little pop-up that says you accept that, you realize this is a guided kind of concept, not necessarily this, who knows what's in the actual terms of service. Did you read it? I assume there was a whole bunch of stuff that happened.
Not in detail, okay. Although the company says this is not supposed, in no uncertain terms, this is not supposed to replace actual medical advice.
Right, that from kind of thing.
It's the WebMD model.
Yeah. Right, you know. But I'm sure people use this to track information. There's lots of apps that let you track this kind of stuff if people are trying to get pregnant. So the fact that Glow is doing it and they're doing that weird community payment system, that seems like an interesting and somewhat altruistic kind of concept of you know, a bunch of people who actually have a shared interest and want to help each other that way. I don't think anyone's going to try to sue based on misuse of the app.
Oh, I think somebody will try to.
I'm sorry. No one will be successful
ASAP
in the suit.
Right.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
I doubt there'll be a successful suit there. But it's an interesting startup to do. It's there's a lot of, for PayPal. I'm just kind of curious. What's the link?
Well, it's
there?
Not PayPal. It's the former guy.
The guy who did PayPal. What's his
data? It's about data collection. He's like, I know how to take big data and manage it. And it's kind of brave to go after healthcare. That's a tricky area. I'll give him that. Let's finish our roundtable with Acer making noises that maybe Windows ain't for them anymore.
Yeah, so Acer reported its financials for quarter two of 2013. It had a net loss of $11.4 million compared to a net profit of $1.7 million at the same time last year. 90% of that came from Windows products. Now, on the conference call, though, Acer's president, Jim Wang, told investors, quote, we are trying to grow our non-Windows business as soon as possible. He says Android is very popular in smartphones and dominant tablets. I also see a new market there for Chromebooks. Wang said that Android devices and tablets, they could likely contribute 10 to 12% of Acer's revenue by the end of this year, may grow up to 30% in 2014, and the rest will come from Windows devices. Acer chairman J.T. Wang says Microsoft has to do something to reestablish or reinforce the confidence amongst PC users, because people just aren't buying these PCs. Ken, we got Lenovo, HP, and now the world's fourth largest PC maker. That's Acer. Seems to imply Windows is not the future. Should they be freaking out at this point?
I think they're probably extremely concerned. You know, we're finally seeing the market settle out from Microsoft dominance for so long, and this could easily be the halo effect of the success of Android on personal devices too, on portable devices. So, you know, these aren't huge shift numbers. I mean, it's not tectonic. We're not talking Microsoft is losing half its user base, and realistically, corporate use is not going to go away. So I don't think that threat is there yet. But, you know, personal use, yeah, I think Microsoft is losing a little bit. Obviously, the, you know, Windows 8 did not go over very well, or you know, and their tablets are not going well. So the shine, whatever shine they still had, is really dulling. And the future is Android, and Apple still has its very nice, happy, comfortable, profitable place. And Windows isn't losing money at this point. you know, it, and we have to be careful not to go all doom and gloom just because a couple of percentage points changed one direction or another. Mm-hmm. But obviously there's, you know, some strategy needs to be shifted if Windows wants to stay where they're at.
Yeah, I look at this and I feel like it's Microsoft's game to lose still, which is a position so many have been in. Nokia was in that position for a long time, too, and they lost. And now they're trying to make a comeback. But I feel like the problem is less of Microsoft losing on the PC platform than Microsoft being limited to winning on the PC platform as that platform shrinks. I don't look at a Chromebook. I don't look at Android as a valid replacement for a Windows laptop or a Windows desktop yet. And I think there's a long time before that may or may not happen. I think what will happen first is that that PC laptop and desktop market shrinks far enough that that starts to become a real issue for Microsoft. And they haven't shown that they can really capture anything outside of that market in the growing areas of tablets or even better, create some kind of new platform like a wearable platform or some other form factor.
I think the fact that Windows is tied into Xbox might help it in the long term. If the applications are cross-platform, that might help it with 8.1. The fact is if Acer's revenue is only 70% Microsoft or Microsoft based, that's still a lot of freaking money. So the idea that Android is moving towards the future, I could see Android becoming more and more of a full featured operating system. We've seen a lot of modifications, like Samsung does this with multi-windowed modes. Should Android decide at any point that its tablet interface can be optimized for multi-window experiences, I don't know, snapping tiles together, sound familiar? If they could do that, which seems pretty trivial at this point, if they wanted to do that, they could probably annoy Microsoft to no end at that point. But we'll see if they want to do that, because Microsoft still makes money on Android anyway. Yeah. They have all the patents on Android as far as they're concerned. So they're like, you know, Android can win. We'll make money on you too. What's the difference?
Yeah. I think the biggest turn will be if they ever put out Office for Android. Office for Chromebook.
A real Office?
They a real Office. Yeah.
Not the thing they came out with.
The web stuff is...
Well, they have that iOS thing the Android one that's just like the iOS one. You need to have a subscription. Just came out. It's just as crippled.
Oh, yeah. Subscription model. Excellent. Yeah, that'll work.
All right. Let's move on to the randomizer. Had a straw poll today for the randomizer between YouTube determining that Batman was the most popular superhero as far as traffic to videos goes on as part of their Geek Week thing, and IBM research revealing new silicon chip foundation inspired by the human brain. Well, guess which one won? 72% to 28%. IBM's making a human brain. Actually, what they're talking about, it was last year that they came out with Synapse, a neurosynaptic computing chip, and now this is in combination with DARPA. They're showing software to run it, multi-threaded software. They can simulate neuron models, the building blocks of a programming system to say, okay, we've got these chips that work like the human brain. They're low power. They don't do linear processing. This is a revolution in how chip architecture works. And now we've got software. We've got a new programming model to break out of that sequential operation mold.
And the first thing they're going to ask it is, who's your favorite superhero?
So, IBM Brain,
we built it like
Batman. Would be the Vision, wouldn't it? The answer would be the
Ultron,
Vision.
Actually. I think.
Oh, Ultron. Oh, yeah.
Maybe, right. Especially now.
We hope for the Vision.
If people don't know, the brain just operates on a few watts, and it's only a couple of liters large. That's a lot of processing power in your head. Right there.
I freaking love what IBM does. It's like, okay, they used to make personal computers, and that was the thing you'd have, you know, the simple black box or your beige box. And they're like, now we're just going to make this robot will compete with people on Jeopardy, and now we're going to make a brain over there. I just would love to be in the room, their think tank. I guess they could replace their think tank once they make a bunch of these brains. They could just talk to each other.
I just find it amazing. You know, we don't think about IBM that often. I mean, they are this... a presence that's always in the back of our minds. You know, they were huge in more commercial, you know, computers back in the 70s and 80s. We think they've gone away. You know, we don't pay attention to them on a week-to-week basis, but they're kicking stuff like this out that will are the next steps or the next steps, and, you know, may end up us hailing our robot overlords, or may be the things that enable magical stuff that we can't even think about right now. So I'm excited. You know, I hate to fall into the, oh, we're all going to, you know, the Terminator will happen and all that stuff. You know, we're not that good at this stuff, and we'll, you know.
Isn't that why the Terminator will happen? Because we're not that good at this stuff?
No, we're not good enough to make something that will figure itself out like that quickly.
The time travel aspect makes it really far-fetched. Yeah.
All right.
Got a ways to go.
This is the latest time somebody said electronic brain. That's been going on since the 50s. But this is new... The architect. I just want to remind people. This is the architecture mimicking the way the brain works and a software to program it. That's pretty cool. Let's see what's on the calendar.
Tomorrow, August 9th, Google is officially retiring the Latitude location sharing service. Don't cry. It is... Most of the features have kind of been absorbed by other Google services. But that's the deal.
No Google Reader like Outcry. Actually, a little bit. I've seen some people upset.
The
about
six
it,
people.
Not of the love. Let's see what's incoming.
Incoming message.
We've got a message from Brian regarding the smartwatch segment in episode 812. My biggest problem with any wearable tech, Bluetooth headsets, watches, etc., is yet another item I need to remember to charge. Believe it or not, I wear a normal everyday watch, even with my Android phone always in reach, and the battery in my watch will last a decade or more. Can you do the same with the Pebble? What about your headset or Fitbit? I'm a huge tech fan and look forward to all of these great wearable tech inventions, but until the battery situation improves, I'm not likely to participate. That's a really interesting, valid claim.
Yeah.
You left off the University of Illinois reference to Chief Illiniwek at the end. But
why did you read that? I couldn't read that word.
Chief Illiniwek.
I'm just fighting Illini.
Yeah, ILL. Battery life is a big one. Absolutely. I don't want to have to dock my watch every
night.
Why
not? You dock your phone. Why not do the both things at the same time?
Because I already have to. I guess if you could do some kind of wireless mat where you just take off the watch and you set it on the mat.
We need the walls of our houses to actually wirelessly charge everything in the house. Then we don't have to think about it.
So just constant power.
Yeah.
Yeah, constant power. That would be perfect.
What could possibly go wrong?
I love my Pebble. And you know, they've got it working at about 5 days of charge now. So that's great. And you know, I've heard Leo sort of complain about watches and is anybody wearing watches these days? My teenagers wear watches. Watches are back one way or the other. It's a form factor that is not gone. And I think it is the next logical step for wearable computing, either as an accessory to your smartphone or as they get more sophisticated. So, the battery life will improve, and maybe that will be the thing that gets it more and more accepted. But we're so used to charging so many things now anyway. Batteries are everywhere, and the battery and that means that a lot of development is going into battery tech and ultra capacitor tech and so forth. It will only improve, and these things are only going to become more and more pervasive in our lives.
Got another email from Tony, a couple different emails. This is also on the smartwatch front. Tony says he uses a Sony smartwatch, loves it, uses it to read and reply to text when customers are around. I guess that means at work. Chris, who lives in Washington, D.C., says, as somebody who walks pretty much everywhere, I find my smartwatch really helpful. I tend to use Bluetooth headsets to listen to podcasts, music, keep the phone in my pocket or backpack. So being able to see the texts, the subject of emails, caller ID info, stuff like that, particularly helpful, especially since my hands are usually busy with dog leashes and coffee cups.
And these guys are part of the 14% that IDC said like smartwatches. 14% are like, yay!
Good life. Dog leashes, coffee cups, and smartwatches. Not bad. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Tony. Thank you, Ken Denmead, for joining us today. As we mentioned, you're at Make now. What got stuff to tell people about? Let folks know what you're up to over there.
How much time have we got left in the broadcast? We are in week 5 out of 6 of Maker Camp right now, which is a program we're partnered with Google doing a virtual summer camp where every day we have live programming, helping kids do projects at home over the summer. And we have a couple of great virtual field trips coming up. I believe tomorrow we're going to go hang out with Imogen Heap, and next week we'll be going down to Pixar. We have World Maker Faire coming up in New York in September, the East Coast version of our wonderful live maker hangout convention extravaganza, which is fantastic. If you're on the East Coast, I really encourage folks to come join that. It's the best experience you'll ever have. And we have the second version of our 3D printer shootout rolling out in print and online this fall. We just had our big 3D printer weekend up in Sebastopol this last weekend. We had something like 22, 23 different new 3D printers that came out just in the last year. We put them through their paces, and we're going to tell everybody what the best ones are for you, for your price point, for your level of sophistication. So keep an eye out for that.
I am looking forward to that. MakeZine.com, folks. Thank you, Ken. And thank you, folks, for submitting to our subreddit, technewstoday.reddit.com. Helps us figure out our lineup each and every day. You can find us on the web at twit.tv/TNT. Email us, TNT@twit.tv, or give us a call. Leave us a voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW. We'll be back tomorrow with Julio Ojeda Zapata as our guest and Len Peralta drawing illustrations as we talk about the stories of the day. See you then.
Motocamera. Moto X camera is the new thing that Liz came up with.
No more jazz hands.
Yeah, Moto X cam.
If what you want to do is take a picture, then yes, jazz.